leading up to the entrance of the museum. It was eerie to see it so deserted. Clouds of pigeons and birds ambled around the courtyard like they were wishing each other a pleasant afternoon. "What are you trying to tell me, Mom? Is there something I'm supposed to see here?" "Hey, this ship hasn't sunk yet," she said, tearing her gaze away from the museum. "We may have one sail, but we're still going." Another laugh. "I appreciate the metaphor you chose on my behalf. I'm not sure how you can keep this sensibility about you. I suppose when you're worried, that's when I'll know we're in real danger." Etta had seen the young, stylish couple making their way down the sidewalk toward them, the woman's coat a bright pop of red against the charred surroundings. The man's face was hidden beneath the rim of his hat, but he tilted his face up as they approached. Nicholas stepped closer to the gates to let them pass. The man assessed him coolly, before muttering something to the woman at his side before they passed by.
"Can we leave this place, please?" Nicholas said, teeth clenched. "If there's nothing here, I think that we should go."
"But he'd just been talking about hopping the fence. What's wrong?"
"Nothing," he said. "Please, let's leave."
She looked around, trying to find the source of his concern. But aside from a few men and women standing on the other side of the street, she couldn't see anything that should have triggered that kind of reaction, aside from the obvious discomfort of being in a strange place, in a stranger time. "All right," she said, putting a hand on his back. He tore away from the touch, and every inch of Etta's skin stung with embarrassment. Etta trailed behind him as he walked back in the direction they'd come from. She didn't really think he had a destination in mind. He barely looked up, except to acknowledge the flow of traffic. It wasn't until she got caught on the opposite sidewalk, waiting for a stream of cars to pass, that he finally stopped and whirled around. And as sharp as his anger had been, his relief was soft, palpable, as he waited for her. Etta hurried to his side, but he still didn't move. His throat worked as he swallowed. "You don't have to explain," she said. "Everything about this is hard."
"It's not that," he said, his whole face tight with strain as he eyed the street. "It's only you resign yourself to a certain invisibility when you look as I do. I didn't expect the opposite to be true in this time, and I find I don't like the attention, the looks."
"You idiot," Etta told herself. What a privilege it was to never feel like you had to take stock of your surroundings or gauge everyone's reactions to the color of your skin. Of course he felt uncomfortable. Of course. And if he'd never been to this time before, he wouldn't be able to predict people's reactions.
"I don't mean to be so irritable," he muttered.
When he looked at her again, his eyes weren't as wild as they'd been before.
"But I cannot be what I'm not."
"I wouldn't want you to be anyone but yourself. I'm glad you told me," Etta said. "I want to understand how you feel." Something she said made him pull back again. He opened his mouth and Etta knew what was coming, the way he would try to wedge more space between them.
"Miss,
don't you dare call me Miss Spencer," she warned. "It kills me when you act like we aren't even friends."
"We aren't friends," he said,
and she couldn't help it, she flinched. One of them had clearly misunderstood whatever was between them. Apparently it had been her. Etta charged away from him down the sidewalk. He caught up to her in three long strides and took her arm in his hand, forcing her to stop. She couldn't bring herself to look up. She only waited for Nicholas to speak.
"I forget myself with you," he said roughly. "I forget the rules. I forget every other living soul in this world. Do you understand?"
"We are not friends." Because to him, they were. Her heart threw itself at her ribcage, hard enough that for a moment she couldn't breathe. "I don't care about rules or anyone else. People are awful. They're idiots. And if they try to hurt you, I won't need the revolver. I care about you. And all I ask is that you try not to make me feel like an idiot for it. You're supposed to..." She clenched her hands to keep from gripping his shoulders. "You're my partner." Etta risked a glance, meeting his eyes. That same flush crept up her throat, washing over her cheeks. Her hands hovered above the warm, smooth skin of his strong forearms,
and for a moment she wondered what it would be like to touch him there, to ease some softness into the rigid lines. Stop it. She knew herself well enough to know that if she kept looking, if she leaned forward like she wanted to, rocked up onto her toes, and he pulled away again, this partner thing would get very complicated very quickly. And Etta couldn't think of that now. She couldn't think of his jawline, the scars and nicks in his skin, his lips as they parted, the way the fabric of his shirt would feel between her fingers. Home, she reminded herself, prickling and sensitive to the cool autumn air. Okay, she said, crossing her arms over her chest, looking back in the direction of the museum. Glad that's settled. Back to business. Nicholas raised a brow. Hardly, but I take your point. The afternoon was creeping on, and they needed every hour of the day. She didn't want to try to imagine where they would have to sleep if they were caught here another day, and she also didn't want to think about how easy it would have been to find out the statue's location by plugging it into a search engine, or even just asking Alice, who had always given the Internet a run for its money in her breadth of knowledge and speed of recall. The thought of Alice gripped her, pinned her in place with a weight she couldn't fully shake off. Think, think, think. She should know this. She must know it. She'd felt something looking past the gates to the solemn museum, a flutter of awareness. But when Etta closed her eyes, trying to picture the empty courtyard, what she saw wasn't the deserted steps or daunting locks. Instead, she was on her back, on the couch in her living room at home, looking up at her mother's paintings on the wall. The third one down, square in the middle, was of this very same scene, birds scattering as a younger Alice walked through them. The answer seemed to drift down from the sky like a lone feather, landing right on top of her head. No, she thought. No. It couldn't be that simple. The clue was most likely about the Elgin marbles as they'd thought. But to find them, to find the passage, she'd need to do what she and her mother always did when they needed something explained. Ask Alice. Alice, who had grown up in London during the war. Alice, whose father was a curator at the British Museum. Alice, who had shown them the house she'd grown up in at least three times. She turned toward Nicholas, trying to steel herself to tell him without going to pieces, but his gaze was fixed across the street, where a man in a trench coat and hat stood leaning against a gleaming mailbox. There was a folded newspaper in his hands, but he didn't seem to be reading it. What's wrong? She whispered, watching Nicholas's shoulders grow rigid. Start walking, he said, voice low. We need to keep moving. I know where we have to go, she told him. Just follow me. Etta wasn't sure when she noticed it, when the suspicion curling at her neck like a stray strand of hair became strong enough to force her to look back over her shoulder. The man with the trench coat was matching their pace. A woman in a rich brown suit drifted in and out of sight, but always reappeared. Nicholas nodded, giving her the last confirmation. They were being followed. Etta took in the street around them, searching for a place where they could talk, when a burst of familiar red caught her eye. Without stopping to explain herself, she lifted an arm and waved, flagging the bus down. Etta! The driver waved back in acknowledgement as she rushed to his window. The scrape of Nicholas's hurried steps trailed behind her. What is this madness? He asked, his teeth gritted. The window rattled open. Entrance is at the rear, the driver began. Does this bus cut through Kensington? Etta asked. The bus driver was an older gentleman, his belly almost large enough to touch the wheel. But he had an open face and a friendly smile.
It does indeed, love. I've got no official stops, though. The conductor will be able to tell you how much you owe. Just give me a smile and a wave, and I'll let you off.
The entrance to the bus was open, at the vehicle's right rear. Etta hauled herself up using the pole, and after an uneasy look, Nicholas followed. Etta should have pulled him into the nearest seat and just sat. Instead, she tried to move them toward the front, where the driver would have a better view of her, and she would have a better view of the road. But she'd forgotten that while she had 17 years of bus riding experience, Nicholas had none. The moment the bus pulled back into traffic, he swayed drunkenly, nearly taking out a little boy and an older woman with a bag of groceries. "Excuse us," she said, gripping his arm and dragging him upright. She nodded to the supports hanging from the ceiling. "Grab those. Just go slow." Getting to the front of the bus was a sluggish, lurching process, even for someone used to the heaving decks of ships. Nicholas collapsed onto the seat, a river of sweat working its way down the side of his face. One hand clenched the back of the seat, the other her knee.
"My God!" he shouted over the roar of the engine. "What is that smell?"
A man in uniform, likely the conductor the driver had mentioned, came down the stairs from the upper level. He had a kind of rack hanging around his neck, with small, brightly colored tickets held in place by small sprigs.
"That would be petrol, lad."
Nicholas gave Etta a look of utter betrayal.
"Will we suffocate before we arrive?"
The conductor shook his head, laughing. Etta forced herself to laugh too, flashing Nicholas a warning look. But he'd clearly recognized his mistake. He pressed a hand to his forehead and sighed at his own slip.
"Destination?"
"Kensington," said Etta.
"2 pennies each."
To her surprise, Nicholas dug into his bag and turned over what looked to be actual copper coins, not the gold she'd expected to barter with. The man dutifully dispensed their tickets and moved on to the other new passengers.
"Exchange the gold and some of my payment," he explained. "We've enough to get by."
"But that was your payment for bringing Sophia and me to New York," she said, guilt slicing through her. He waved a hand, dismissing this.
"Focus your concern on the guardians who've already managed to track us here."
"The man with the newspaper was definitely a guardian," she pressed, somehow already knowing the answer. "Are you sure?"
"I've never been to this year," he said in a low voice. "I haven't met the Ironwood guardians who call it their home. But what other reason could he and that woman, the one in the brown suit, did you see her? What reason could they have for tracking us?"
It seemed so unfair that Ironwood's guardians had already found them. Etta sighed, leaning her forehead against the seat in front of them. So much for getting ahead and keeping her movements and travels quiet from the old man. He leaned forward to rest his elbows on his knees, and dragged his hand back over his closely cropped hair.
"He has guardians watching every known passage. They likely were following us for longer than we even realized. They have to be Ironwoods."
Her brain had been so cluttered with shock and foggy from traveler sickness that she hadn't even thought about Cyrus's reaction to finding them gone. "How much trouble are we in?" Etta asked quietly.
"Unfortunately, if Ironwood wants us brought in for acting without his permission, a world of it. We'll be held in one of the Ironwood properties in this time to await the old man and whatever punishment he decides to mete out. And he isn't renowned for his forgiveness."
Nicholas let a rough smile break through the tension on his face.
"Fortunately, however, he doesn't yet know we pirates are damned hard to capture."
The last time Etta had seen the house was 5 years ago, over 70 years in the future. It had been freezing, the kind of day that switched from rain to sleet every other second, where water seemed to be coming at you from all sides. The last time she'd seen this flat-roofed, three-story beige brick house, this green door with its gold lion-shaped knocker, had been through a rental car window. Etta had been tired and annoyed and cold, pretending to be asleep to end the tour a little faster. She could have smacked 12-year-old Etta, because the longer they stood in front of the house's gate, the less sure she was that they'd found the right one. She was definitely not sure that she wanted to ring the bell at any rate.
"You said you'd been here before," Nicholas reminded her. "If your instincts are telling you this is the place, I believe it."
If her mother and Alice had brought her here 3 times, then they wanted her to remember it, how to find it. But Alice...
"Will you be all right?" he asked quietly. "I can speak to her if it feels unbearable."
The house faced Kensington Square, a short walk south from the palace and gardens. The neighborhood was quiet, beautiful, nearly untouched by war. The mid-afternoon sun disappeared as the sky grayed over with clouds, but the trees in the park stood out in flaming contrast, all gold and red. Men worked nearby, pulling up some of the fences and railings, collecting them in piles to be carted away. Here and there were small gardens, including one in front of the green door. Etta shook her head. She was grateful for the offer, but if he was right and she really couldn't save Alice, then... this is my last chance to see her. The thought broke something wide open in her. Nicholas opened the gate and gestured for her to enter. Etta set her shoulders back, stomach flipping between excitement and dread. Then she lifted the knocker and pounded out 3 sharp knocks. For a terrible second, Etta thought no one was home. She leaned forward, her ear against the wood, when she heard a girl cry, "Just a moment!" and the sound of feet on the stairs. Etta stepped back. Something scraped, the peephole cover maybe. She glanced at Nicholas, who stood at the base of the steps with one hand on his bag. There was an audible gasp, a cry as the door flew open.
"Rosie, but what are you doing?"
Etta drank down the sight of her in one long gulp. The girl's long auburn hair was loose around her shoulders, her face shaded by a green felt hat. The collar of her grayish-green dress had been unbuttoned down to the spot where a white patch was placed over the pocket on her chest, its letters reading WVS, Civil Defense. She was so young, unbelievably young. Alice had freckles, a whole galaxy of them spread across her nose and cheekbones. Etta had seen pictures, but this Alice hadn't yet lost the baby fat from her round face. It was her eyes that Etta instantly recognized, that pale gray she knew so well. Etta's whole body seemed to seize, her voice too thick to speak, and she had to cross her arms over her chest to keep from throwing them around her.
"You're not Rose," Alice said slowly,
gripping the door as if prepared to slam it shut.
"No,"
Etta said, reaching out to keep the door open.
"I'm not."
12.
"I haven't any tea to offer you, but there's no milk or sugar for it anyway. Rationing and such. Very sorry."
Alice led them into the front parlor of the house, motioning for Nicholas and Etta to sit on a stiff, overstuffed Victorian couch. She disappeared for a moment, but rather than let her vanish completely, Etta leaned into the hall to track her progress. She returned with glasses of water and a few crackers.
"Everything all right?" Alice asked her.
Etta forced her eyes away from her and onto the painting hanging over the fireplace, an impressionist take on a field of red poppies, and let a smile curve across her lips. It was like seeing another old friend. The thing had traveled, complete in its ornate gold frame, across the Atlantic to Alice and Oscar's apartment on the Upper East Side. But that wouldn't take place for another 10 years. Sheet music was piled neatly on top of a closed piano, and tucked beneath its gleaming wooden body was a small music stand and a violin case, Alice's violin case, containing the violin that Etta would, decades later, hold and practice on for hours every single day. She'd forgotten this, that the war had forced Alice's lessons to come to a halt. She'd only begun playing professionally in her 20s, after she grew restless with London.
"You'll have to excuse me for being rude,"
Alice said, sitting in a leather chair across from her.
"But I've got to be off to my shift in a few minutes."
"That's okay," Etta said, her voice thick with the need to cry. All those things she'd said to her at the Met before the concert. Some things never changed, including, apparently, the way Alice's face softened in sympathy.
"I just have a few questions," Etta continued. "If that's okay with you." "About Rosie?"
she asked, studying Etta as closely as Etta was studying her.
"I'm afraid you're out of luck. I haven't seen her in years."
Etta shifted uncomfortably in her seat at Alice's firm tone. Up until now, Etta had been convinced the coolness she'd detected from her had been mere wary politeness. Now she recognized it for what it was, outright suspicion. Etta's appearance, so close to her mother's, must have caught Alice completely off guard at the door. "She's not going to tell us anything." Did she actually know anything at this point in time?
"Are you close to her?"
Etta asked.
"Hardly,"
Alice said, and Etta knew it to be a lie, just based on how she'd opened the door.
"We went to school together until the professor, her grandfather, passed. She disappeared on and off, ran with a certain crowd, but she stayed with us occasionally."
As I said before, I haven't seen her in years.
Etta shifted in her seat, drawing a look of concern from Nicholas, who'd been studying his water for the entire duration of the conversation, as if he couldn't quite believe there wasn't dirt swimming in it.
I don't mean to be rude, Alice said again, this time with more steel in her tone. But who are you, and why are you here?
Might as well have it out than keep burning time.
My name is Etta. I'm her daughter.
Nicholas sprayed the water he'd just taken a sip of, subsequently pounding his chest and choking on what he'd managed to swallow. He spun toward her in disbelief.
Daughter,
Alice said, her voice changing completely. She was practically chirping.
That's wonderful! My goodness, you look so much alike, it's startling. I should have known. Etta, is it short for something? What century were you born in? It's so confusing to meet out of order, you know.
A flood of confusing, conflicting emotions, anger, excitement, hope, frustration, swept through Etta, and it took her a second to catch her breath and process this.
Henrietta, Etta said. And this is Nicholas Carter.
Your servant, ma'am, Nicholas said with a nod.
He put a steadying hand on Etta's shoulder and kept her firmly in place. Etta was grateful, as she felt she was about to float up out of her skin.
But, darling, who's your father? Alice asked. Henrietta, is it possibly Henry?
Etta felt the world bottom out for the second time in less than a minute.
Henry, she whispered.
Etta doesn't know her father, Nicholas explained. I'm afraid the situation is rather complicated.
He did the best that he could to explain what had brought them both to her doorstep, a far better job than Etta would have managed with the thousands of thoughts rattling around her head. She watched Alice's expression transform again, from horror to amazement, to something that looked like genuine fear.
Then you're like us, Etta asked. I'm not even sure where to start with my questions. I wish!
Alice let out a faint laugh, looking as overcome as Etta felt.
Professor Linden, your great-grandfather, was cousin to my father, a great friend and mentor. Neither he nor I inherited the ability from the Linden side of our family.
A guardian, then, Nicholas confirmed.
Etta sat back, stunned. In her heart, Alice had always been the grandmother she'd never had. Love had been enough to sustain that feeling, even knowing there wasn't a drop of shared blood between them. But apparently they were from the same family. Distantly, maybe, but both Lindens all the same. Alice had aged like anyone else, and when Etta's mother had escaped Ironwood, Alice had gone to find her. Etta felt the tears prick her eyes again, swamped with the now familiar guilt, the frustration of knowing the truth too late. Alice protected us. She was a guardian in every sense of the word.
They had quite a little game going, Alice continued. The professor would happen upon some relic and use my father to bring it into the museum. It was very hush-hush, of course.
She lifted a chain from under her plain uniform dress, showing them the coin hanging from it.
Rose brought this back from a holiday in Greece. Greece before Christ.
How did she end up with the Ironwoods? Nicholas asked.
The professor worked very hard to keep her away from the other families, especially them, Alice explained. I'm sure you know, but they were at war with one another over who should be making the laws for the families, and then it was all about revenge for the natural times that were rewritten and the loved ones murdered. The professor always said that the traveler lines were on the verge of destroying themselves. As the last two living Lindens, they simply hid, rather than take sides. Once Ironwood's control over traveling was secured, and the professor passed away, Rose spent some time with a group that banded together to travel. They called themselves refugees.
Nicholas set his empty glass down on the side table with a bit too much force.
Refugees, you said?
Alice nodded.
I've heard of a group like that,
Nicholas explained, giving Etta a sidelong glance.
Refugees, to us, are people who, after the timeline has changed, find themselves without a home to return to. I might have been prevented from leaving my time, exiled to it, but they lost their natural times. The years they were born to, the ones they had grown and thrived in, were lost.
Sophia mentioned that, Etta said. That when the timeline changes and a traveler's natural time is affected by a big enough shift, they don't cease to exist. But everything and everyone they'd known might be lost.
Precisely. It happened constantly during the war between the families. The timeline became so unstable, so unpredictable, that many began to fear what might happen if it continued. Some of the remnants from the Jacaranda and Hemlock families eventually came to Ironwood and pledged their service and allegiance. But there was a group that dogged him for years, trying to sabotage his business holdings and retaliate on behalf of their dead loved ones. Thorns. That's what Ironwood calls them. They're constantly trying to create snags in the timeline that will restore their futures. That's a dangerous group for your mother to have aligned with. The old man made it sound like she'd profusely infiltrated the family and manipulated them.
Etta trailed off, looking at him. Is it possible that they were also trying to find the astrolabe and knew he wanted it, or that he was on its trail?
That's a logical assumption.
Nicholas rubbed his chin.
Perhaps they know where it's hidden, too. Only, it seems the sort of thing they'd wish to use.
The thought settled between the three of them, as heavy as a thundercloud. Etta braced herself for thunder, for the lightning bolt of dread.
It's been a pleasure to meet you, but...
Alice stood suddenly, gathering up the water glasses.
I'm sorry, I've really got to be going.
Etta studied the girl, recognizing the evasion for what it was.
What do you know about the astrolabe?
Nothing, Alice said, keeping her back to them.
I'm sorry, I don't know anything about it.
Not yet, not yet, please not yet. Etta felt almost desperate with panic.
You can't go yet.
I'm just trying to get back to Rosie, she tried.
I think this is the only way.
If I find the astrolabe, I'll find her. Please. Whatever you know, however small, could help us.
You may be her daughter, but it feels like such... betrayal, Alice said, her voice small. She didn't want anyone to find it, least of all the Ironwoods.
Why? Etta asked. Nicholas crossed and uncrossed his legs, as if suddenly unable to settle himself in a comfortable position.
At least tell me that. She thought... God forgive me. She thought they'd use it for their own ends, that they'd damage the world irrevocably for their own gain, Alice said. It's a family heirloom. It did belong to us for whatever that's worth, and we debated for years over what to do with it, to let it remain where the professor's father hid it, or to move it. It was supposed to stay lost, but then Ironwood somehow started to get close. Rose didn't move it from its original hiding spot until he nearly found it. She and the professor should have just destroyed it, but they couldn't bring themselves to do it. History is too important to them.
Alice set the small porcelain figurine of a tiger she'd been fussing with back down on the fireplace mantelpiece, continuing.
Ironwood thought she'd be stupid enough to trick and use, and now I suppose he's trying the same with you.
Etta shook her head. I won't let him have it. I'm just trying to get home, back to her, and... back to you. She turned slowly.
Me?
Yes, Etta said, standing up and crossing the room. She travels to the future, and you're there to help both her and me. You live in New York. There's a really handsome Polish violinist in your future. Alice held up her hands, stopping her.
Don't tell me any more. I mean it. I can see in your face that there's something you want to tell me, but you can't. I might not be able to alter the timeline, but you can, just by telling me. And I'm starting to find this story rather convenient.
Etta looked around the room again, trying to find some proof that she knew Alice, the future Alice. Her eyes landed on the painting.
I know you bought this painting while you were walking along the Seine. You bought it because someone wrote a beautiful poem in French on the back. And I know your father loathes it, and you actually bolted it to the wall to keep him from taking it down.
Alice reached up, pressing her fingers against the bottom of the frame. It didn't budge. She turned back to them, shaking her head.
I want to help you, but she's protected me for so long, I feel that it's my turn to do the same.
It was so Alice. This woman had guarded them over the years like a lioness defending her cubs. It made Etta want to hug her that much more, even as Nicholas tensed beside her, frustration plain on his face. I'm not interested in changing the future, her future, Etta said. For one thing, it would completely change my life. There is no way I'm letting Ironwood have access to my time, either. The couch squeaked as Nicholas stood and made his way to the window. He crossed his arms over his chest and surveyed the people passing on the sidewalk below. All right, Alice said, bringing her hands red. I don't know anything about where it is. I'm sorry, but I suppose it wouldn't hurt to tell you that it's the last of the four. Long ago, each family had one. Three of them were either lost or destroyed by rivals in the other families. So it was exactly as Nicholas and Julian had thought. This one is the last of its kind, Alice said, which is a blessing, considering what it's capable of. Reading passages, you mean? Etta clarified. Alice blinked. No. Creating passages. Creating them? Etta asked, looking back toward Nicholas just as his gaze shot over to hers. Her own shock was reflected on his face. That couldn't be right. Yes, Alice said, eyes wide as she realized neither of them knew this. My impression is that many of the passages are becoming unstable or collapsing because of traveler deaths and, well, old age. As Rose explained it, what Ironwood and his rivals, the Thorns as you called them, what they want is to gain access to years that have been closed to them and affect events there. Whoever controls the astrolabe could potentially control the whole of time. Oh my God, thought Etta. No wonder Ironwood had been willing to sacrifice his sons and grandson in the search of it. This was the ultimate prize, the trump card of travelers. If his control wasn't already complete, it would be once he had it in hand. All people in all ages could be affected by whatever Ironwood had planned. Did this mean that the passages weren't a natural phenomenon that travelers had found and tentatively stepped through centuries ago? They'd been made by the ancestors of these families for their personal use. No wonder there were years without passages, and that so many passages were uncharted. They must have predated when the families began to record the destinations, or they had simply been forgotten altogether. Or some passages were secret, created for one particular family's use alone. How do the Thorns fit into this? Nicholas asked. The notes of the symphony of lives, desires, and revenge suddenly swelled into a chorus of generations, blasting through Etta's mind. She already knew the answer to his question. They're united in wanting to create passages to the past, to return to what they all see as the original timeline, to restore the centuries and years that orphaned them when Ironwood began to bend the timeline to suit his needs. Which wouldn't be the future she had grown up in. Days in the park, lessons with Alice, tea with her mom. For a moment, Etta wasn't sure which was more terrifying, if Ironwood moved forward into the future, or if the Thorns interfered with the past. And those who were lost to them, Alice added. To save them. The way I want to save you. Etta pressed her fingers against her mouth, trying to seal in the whirlwind of sudden uncertainty whipping through her. How is what I want to do any different than what they want to do? Why does Alice deserve to live more than their loved ones? No, she couldn't think about it. Alice deserved to live. She didn't deserve to die, not the way she had. They wouldn't dare, Nicholas said. She could tell he was trying to avoid looking at her, even as he added, We cannot save the dead. We cannot even warn them, should we cross paths with them. Only if you follow the rules, Alice pointed out. The rules Ironwood established when he rose to power. He destroyed everything, including our way of life. More secrets, more to agonize over, more reasons to find the astrolabe as soon as they possibly could. Etta rubbed at the spot between her eyes that had begun to pound in time with her heart. Just keep going. Stopping to think about this too hard would only keep her locked in a cycle of doubt, and she couldn't afford to be overwhelmed just then. She needed to take things as they came. Her plan would stay the same. Find the astrolabe, save her mom, save Alice. Escape Ironwood if they had to. I wish it could be back the way it was, when the families flourished and balanced out each other's powers, Alice said. The professor and my father used to talk about it very wistfully. Each family had a proper role, and they alternated them every few decades to ensure no family undermined another, and the timeline remained stable.
What kind of roles? Etta asked, curious.
Record keepers, financiers, and shifters. That last one entailed correcting any changes to the timeline and checking on the stability of the passages themselves, Alice explained. And of course one family would hold trials and enforce punishments for breaking the rules. The enforcers.
That was ages ago, Nicholas said dismissively. Corruption unraveled it rather neatly. My understanding is that it only worked well for a few hundred years, back when the families were still mere alliances and clans.
Alliances? Etta repeated.
What do you mean? Did your mother never tell you about your own history? Alice asked.
She shook her head, trying to beat back the frustration.
It's complicated.
Ah, well, Alice said. No bother.
While it's generally accepted we all come from a common ancestor with the ability, the families today originally existed as alliances between many separate families that united together under banners, the trees we now use as our family names, against their rivals and enemies. That was another time of huge conflict. Everyone was trying to claim centuries and territories to control. It was mostly resolved through treatises and the establishment of the system of roles and laws. You can still see the evidence of how widespread their numbers used to be in the diversity within the remaining members of the families today.
Nicholas flicked his gaze back onto the street below. He shifted again, and now all Etta could see was the long curve of his spine, the strong width of his shoulders, and his left fingers as they tapped against the muscle of his right arm.
Enough history. It hardly matters now. Ask her the question that brought us here, he said, a note of impatience in his voice.
Etta turned to Alice with an apologetic look, but she didn't seem bothered.
Mom left me a series of clues to find it, she said, in a coded letter. A letter that can only be read when a key, a symbol, is placed over it, showing which words are meant to be read, Alice said with a knowing smile. We all used to exchange messages that way.
Etta felt the hair rise on her arms. It was a connection, however thin, to a larger family she'd never known.
We think the next riddle, the clue, is meant to lead us to a passage near the Elgin Marbles, but we're not sure where to find them in this year. I thought you might know, since your father works for the museum.
Can you answer one thing for me first? Alice said. How did you know to come to this house? Did you look up the address? Ask around.
I didn't need to, Etta said. You and Mom brought me by a few times. You said it was very special, that it was important for me to see where you'd grown up.
Alice sighed, sounding almost relieved.
Then both of us wanted you to be able to find me. That's good. We must have known something like this might happen.
The fact was cemented in her now. None of this was a coincidence. Alice, her Alice in the future, had met Etta in the past. She'd known her as nearly an adult before she'd ever met the small wisp of a girl clutching her child-sized violin. This was the reason she and Rose had fought, because Alice knew Etta would come here, because she'd already lived through it. The thought of their inevitability in each other's lives burrowed deep into her heart, past the hardened shell she'd put up to keep herself together.
The museum and the government have taken the marbles underground, Alice said. They're tucked away in the underground, in the tunnel between the Aldwych and Hoban stations. It's not exactly near where I report to work, but I can at least point you in the right direction.
Will we have access to the tunnel? Etta asked.
Both stations are being used as shelters during the air raids, Alice explained. You'll need to find an opportunity when the stations aren't being watched by the police, but you should be able to climb down from the platform and walk through the tunnel. The marbles will be in crates, but they're obvious enough by their size.
Etta nodded, processing this.
Is there a back entrance out of your home?
Nicholas asked suddenly, drawing the curtain shut in front of him.
Well, yes, Alice said, rising slowly. Why?
Two gentlemen in the street are watching this house, he said. Unless they're interested in painting it. I think it's a fair assumption that we've been found.
Through the back door, through the back garden, through a gate that opened out onto a street, Etta had 1 second to celebrate their narrow escape, when the man she'd seen before, the one with the fedora and the newspaper, appeared at the other end of the street.
"I know him," Alice said, grabbing her wrist.
"One of Ironwood's?" Etta asked. She shook her head.
"No, I don't think so. Rosie left me photos to identify them. This one's definitely come around looking for her before, though."
Not an Ironwood guardian. Then who the hell was he? The girl struggled to keep pace with Nicholas's longer strides. He kept one hand buried deep in his bag. If Etta had to guess, it was on the revolver inside. Whether or not he'd actually brought ammunition was anyone's guess. But Etta had a feeling that the answer was... She slammed into something and felt herself ripped away from Alice's grip. One of Etta's feet caught the other, and she landed hard on her bottom, her scraped hands singing in agony. When the spots of black cleared from her eyes, Etta saw a woman, the one in the brown suit, reeling and clutching her nose. Just past her shoulder, Nicholas wheeled around, his face blank with horror. A pair of hands scooped Etta up by the elbows, hauling her back before she could get her feet beneath her. The smell of cologne and sweat flooded her nose, and she threw her head back, trying to hit some soft, fleshy part of him.
"Rose!" the man gasped out. "Rose, damn you!"
"Rose?" A pale fist flew past her face, landing on the man's jaw. Alice's face was glowing red with fury as she shook her hand out, but it was Nicholas who charged past her and tackled the man to the ground. Etta finally had a look at him. Horn-rimmed glasses, a must-tweed suit. It was a different man than the one who'd carried the paper. Younger.
"I'm not,"
he gasped as Nicholas hauled him up with a snarl and launched a fist into his face.
"Not..."
"Not what?" Etta looked at Alice for an answer, but the girl only shrugged and shoved aside the woman in brown, who was still moaning in pain.
"Come on, Carter," Alice called. "Keep moving."
He didn't move, except to raise his fist again.
"Nicholas,"
Etta called.
"Come on."
He finally shook himself out of his anger's grip, dropped the battered man back onto the sidewalk, and ran to catch up to them.
"Are you all right?"
He tried to reach over, but Etta only ran harder, toward the crowds gathering in front of them, and the cars honking to get through. No time. Just run. Run. Her breath burned inside her chest as they pushed through the busy city, dodging through street after street of homes and shops until, after nearly 20 minutes, they reached their destination. Over their heads was a rainbow array of glowing advertising signs and lights. Lemon Heart, BP, Schweppes. And at the center of a traffic circle, a statue of Eros watched the slow crawl of double-decker buses and police cars. Even without the modern billboards, Etta recognized the intersection. They'd run the whole way to Piccadilly Circus, and her blisters and cramping legs and feet were proof of it. Alice looked around, her face pink and gleaming with sweat despite the chill in the air.
"I can't take you all the way there. I'm sorry. I can't miss my shift. There are people depending on me. I wish I could."
Etta swallowed the small, selfish pang of desperation to keep Alice close, and said,
"That's okay. Thank you for getting us this far. Is the underground station much farther?" "It's another 20-minute walk from here," Alice said. "I can give you money for a taxi."
"It'll be easier to lose them on foot," Nicholas said.
"Thank you. Where do we go from here?"
Using the back of her mother's letter and a ballpoint pen, Etta had Alice quickly write out the remainder of the instructions. Head east as the road turns from Piccadilly Circus to Swiss Court, to Cranbourne Street to Carrick, up King Street past St. Paul's Cathedral, back down to Russell, right on Catherine Street once you pass the Royal Opera House. All at once, Etta missed her phone and satellites and the luxury of never having to feel lost.
"Be safe,"
Alice said, throwing her arms around her. The faint anxiety that prickled over Etta's skin sparked into paralyzing dread. No time. No time for this, but...
"We must go," she heard Nicholas say gently, in warning.
She pulled back with a bone-deep reluctance, an aching hollowness in the pit of her stomach. "What you're speaking of isn't a matter of morality. It's an impossibility. What would change? What could change if she warned Alice now?" The thought gnawed on her. It would be a small ripple, wouldn't it? A small change in an enormous sea of moments.
If she couldn't travel back to her time and pull Alice to safety without crossing paths with herself, she could at least do this. She could rewrite that moment. The pale terror of her instructor's face. The blood. Alice.
No, no, none of that, Alice interrupted. No tears, no secrets. I want the life I'm meant to have, Etta. It's as simple as that. My father always says that the way to truly live is to do so without expectation or fear hanging over you, affecting your choices. And that's bloody hard to do with you travelers coming and going. I want to know you the way you know me one day. I want to play my violin, make my mistakes, fall in love, live in as many different cities as I can. Would you really take that from me?
Etta couldn't breathe. Her hands were curling and uncurling at her side, and she was trembling with the effort to keep from sobbing. She glanced at Nicholas, who had turned his head to survey the crowd, and was politely pretending he wasn't listening. Finally, she shook her head.
We're called guardians because we're meant to take care of you lot, as you take care of our world. And Etta, don't forget, the truly remarkable thing about your life is that you're not bound to live it straightforward like the rest of us. You can come and see me for a visit any time. It's like how the song goes. I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places.
Etta pulled back, half stunned to hear those words again. She watched Alice wave and step into the rush of bodies around them, until even the flash of her bright hair dimmed and disappeared completely.
Etta, are you all right?
She didn't realize Nicholas was speaking to her until he reached over, brushing a thumb over her unhurt cheek. She said that before, the last time I saw her. Just before.
Before she died.
She needed to say it. She needed to accept it, because it was clear to her now, so agonizingly clear, that Alice remembered this meeting. She knew Etta would try to tell her about what would happen to her, and she, in her very Alice way, wanted to let her know what she had said in the past was true. She didn't want to know. She didn't want to change the life she'd lived with Etta up to that point. But Alice had loved her enough to still figure to keep her from having to travel, or at least travel without knowing the truth. Maybe that's why her mom had been so firmly against telling Etta. She could be unsentimental when Alice and Etta couldn't.
She doesn't want me to save her.
Etta wiped at her eyes, surprised to feel the wet tracks of tears dripping down off her chin.
I'm sorry. I'm just a little overwhelmed. And tired.
All I wanted was to save you. What was she even going back to now? Was there a point to performing in any kind of debut, having any kind of career if Alice couldn't see it? She knew Alice had been in what Rose called the twilight years of her life. She'd lived a long time, and even as a young student, Etta had understood that she wouldn't be around forever. But she couldn't reconcile herself with this. She couldn't understand how any of this was fair. I'll see her again, she thought. Not in my time, and maybe not even soon, but one day.
There's nothing to apologize for. We'll rest as soon as it's safe. But we do need to keep moving, Nicholas said.
Etta nodded and followed. The line of his body was rigid, poised to strike. Sharp, cutting dark eyes assessed each person who passed them. Now and then he rubbed at the broken skin on his bruised knuckles, and she knew that while she was thinking about Alice, his thoughts were locked on what had happened behind the house. She reached over to brush her fingers over the back of his hand, trying to break him out of what looked like a vicious cycle of thoughts. They'd already lost a day trying to solve this clue. They couldn't waste a second more on regrets. Etta began walking faster, nearly at a jog, but he kept up easily with his long strides. Sweeping her gaze around the street, she tried to identify the source of the uneasiness rippling down the back of her neck. "What do you think the man who grabbed me was going to say? He wasn't a what?" she asked. "An enemy? An Ironwood?"
"If Miss Alice is right, and he's not an Ironwood, then it's likely he's a Thorn," Nicholas said slowly. "Equally dangerous, considering they want the Astrolabe as well."
Rose. The man had called her Rose. "He used my mom's name," she said. That man had clearly seen her before if he mistook me for her. He gave one of his curt nods.
Alice implied that your mother was tied to the thorns at one point or another.
Etta frowned. Something about all this was rubbing her the wrong way, brushing up like sandpaper against her attempts to puzzle this out. Her mother had wanted her to travel. She'd known it was inevitable. Etta was beginning to think that the consequences Rose had referenced in her fight with Alice had to do with trying to change the timeline by keeping Etta from going. So why would Rose join a group that wanted to use the astrolabe for itself, and would stop Etta from getting it? Had she pulled the same kind of con on the thorns as she had on the ironwoods? Rose could be cold, guarded, but Etta hadn't realized before now that her mother could also be ruthless. It gave her hope that, if her mom really did believe she could handle this, she recognized there was fight in Etta, too. They were going to have a long conversation when Etta found her, starting with why she hadn't just destroyed the astrolabe in the first place and saved everyone the grief. The sun was setting, and the mood of the city was shifting into something that made her stomach churn. Heavy curtains were being drawn behind windows, and cardboard was being placed in the flat windows of storefronts. The street lamps remained off. The crowds of people began to disperse, breaking off in clusters and heading up the side streets, jumping in whatever bus or taxi was passing by. It was like the city had sucked in one last enormous gasp and was holding its breath. Etta felt as though she were walking along a crack that was threatening to cave in on itself.
"I thought they had electricity," Nicholas said quietly.
The leather satchel at his side bounced between them, but every now and then the back of his hand would brush hers and break the rhythm of her pulse.
"They do," Etta whispered back, glancing back at the milky pink of the sunset.
Was this part of the rationing Alice had mentioned, or was this some kind of power blackout? They passed Leicester Square. Couples dressed in furs and hats were loitering outside of the theaters, sharing cigarettes as if it were any other day in any other year.
"Almost there. Almost there."
"May I ask you something?" Nicholas said into the darkness gathering around them.
A midnight blue clung to the air, that last gasp of afterlight before nightfall. Without any illumination, Etta's other senses came into sharp focus. The smell of gasoline and smoke, the sound of their footsteps, the dryness of her mouth as she tried to swallow.
"You can ask me anything," she told him.
"What will you do when you find the astrolabe?" he asked,
his voice reserved, careful.
"Knowing what it truly does."
Etta didn't want to lie. "Whatever it takes to save my mom, my future."
"Are there any circumstances in which you'd give it to the old man?" he continued.
What a strange question. Was that some kind of test? She raised an eyebrow.
"Would you?"
His lips parted, but just as quickly he turned his gaze up toward the sky as it bruised under the night. "I can only imagine what he'd do with access to more of the future," Etta continued. "It's how badly he wants it, and how far my mom had to go to protect it that scares me. It definitely makes me second-guess giving it to him. Nothing about the old man makes me want to play nice."
"But isn't it the easier solution? Give it to him and get your life back. Your mother. Perform at your concert," he asked, his voice strained.
"What's left of my life at this point, you mean? Whatever parts of it he hasn't torpedoed." Etta didn't want to continue down this line of conversation, not when her own thoughts were still too frustratingly tangled. Her mom was safe for now, and would be, so long as she could get to the astrolabe before Ironwood's deadline. He gave her a helpless look.
"Torpedoed."
"An underwater missile that... You know what?" she said with a faint laugh. "I'll explain later. I'm not so sure it wouldn't be a good idea to torpedo the stupid astrolabe and just be done with
this." "That would be unwise. The whole business of getting home would be made considerably easier by creating a passage, rather than sailing to one in Nassau," Nicholas said. "I hope you'll take this as the compliment it is, but I imagine Ironwood will be eager to see you and your mother as quickly as possible. He might even create one for you."
"We are talking about Cyrus Ironwood, right?" Etta said, brows raised at this little fantasy. "The one who told me he was going to leave me so destitute I was going to have to resort to prostitution." Nicholas groaned.
"We will create one for you and your mother, then."
If we can figure out how to use it, she pointed out. The thought made her feel tired all over again. In truth, at that moment, all she really wanted were two things, her mother and a hot shower. And toothpaste. Three things. The last should have been easy enough to find, and maybe it would have been, if every store they passed hadn't been closed for the day. "Can I ask you a question?" she said, eyes sliding up his profile. He inclined his head, granting permission, but she saw his hands bunch into fists at his side.
"I suppose it's only fair."
"What are you going to do with the money you got from Ironwood?" she asked. "The money you got for bringing me and Sophia to New York." His shoulders slumped as he exhaled.
"I would dearly love to hear your guess."
"You're going to buy a ship," she said instantly.
"Yes. Did Chase tell you that as well?"
Nicholas's gaze swung out to take in the sight of St. Paul's Cathedral, its ornate dome looming between the shadowed buildings surrounding it. "No," she said. "It just seemed right. That's where I see you." Standing under the blaze of the sun, the wind teasing and pulling at his shirt and jacket, the water rolling out beneath them. "Him," she corrected. "Rolling out beneath him, like a sparkling carpet." Nicholas stopped, his arm brushing hers again as he stepped in front of her, looking down in what she thought might have been genuine amazement.
"You could read me so easily."
She smiled, flicking at his chest in a teasing way to keep from doing something else that would embarrass her and likely startle him. "You were so good at it, and you loved it. I could see it in your face. What is it?" His gaze was so heavy, it felt like he had dropped his hands onto her shoulders and was holding on for dear life.
"Etta," he began, his voice a rasp. "You."
There was a movement just behind him, brown and black and white and gray. Three men booking it down the street. The men from before. The one in tweed was pulling something out of his pocket. Thorns. Charging directly at them. Small, silver. Gun. Etta shoved Nicholas hard into the brick wall beside them. He stared back, dazed, just as a bullet screamed by, slicing the air between them. "Run," Etta said, grabbing his wrist. "Run!" He tried to wheel back around to see, but she dragged him forward, feeling his pulse jump beneath her fingers.
"Turn here," he said. "Weave."
The sound was like an inherited memory. She couldn't remember ever having heard it before, but recognized it instantly for the way it seemed to slice through her, striking the marrow of her bones. The revving wail was spinning out of the silence, louder and louder, as the buildings picked up the sound of the sirens and volleyed it between them.
"What the devil is that?"
Nicholas said, spinning around, trying to locate the source.
"Air raid sirens," Etta said, shooting a look back over her shoulder.
The men were slowing at the warning of the approaching attack, as if unsure whether or not to keep going.
"No."
Etta's breath left her in a rush. "To aim." The man out in front fired. The bullet went wide, striking the brick wall behind them. A splatter of dust and debris exploded into her hair, scratching the back of her neck.
"Stop, damn you," one of them called. "Don't make us shoot you." "Hell and damnation," Nicholas forced out between gritted teeth.
Etta was too furious with herself to speak. Why hadn't she even thought about this? She should have pushed to leave Alice's earlier. They should have taken a taxi, anything to get them to the Eldwich station and the passage hidden inside of it as soon as possible. This was the Blitz, for God's sake. Alice had told her 100 times growing up that there had been bombings nearly every night.
"What do we do?"
he shouted. A distant, loud drone choked the words right out of her, made her look up through the clouds for planes.
"We have to go underground," she said.
This, Alice had said, the underground stations were being used as shelters. If they could get to Aldwych, if they could run ahead of the attack, they could reach the passage tonight. But if the bombing began before then, in this area of the city, they'd be dead before they realized what hit them. The Thorns seemed to be having a similar debate. She caught fragments of their conversation.
"Go back! Follow! Not dying!"
They'd passed a shelter in Leicester Square and had seen the tube stop nearby. But Etta didn't want them to go back, not when they could get out of London tonight.
The Thorns seemed to be hoping they would bail, ditch the streets for cover, and Etta had the unsettling feeling of being caught in a deadly game of chicken. Ending up in the same shelter as them would only get her and Nicholas caught in Ironwood's web. She needed them to take the nearest shelter,